As an organized force in North America, feminism can be dated from the abolitionist movement that arose in the 1830s in America and tended to center around the individualist anarchist William Lloyd Garrison. The two dominant ideological influences on the feminism that arose were Quakerism and individualism. And many courageous women prior to this point, by the way, spoke up for feminist ideals, for women's rights. I'm not trying to dismiss them when I say that feminism arose here. I meant feminism as a self-conscious movement, not as a scattering of women who basically did not act in concert. But from the 1830s, it was the rise of a self-conscious women's movement that said, I am speaking for women's rights. And that was really a remarkable thing that had not happened before. Abolitionism was the radical anti-slavery movement that demanded the immediate cessation of slavery on the grounds that every human being was a self-owner. Every human being, black or white, male or female, simply by being human, had a moral jurisdiction over his or her own body that no one could rightfully violate. Now, gradually, abolitionist women were very brave. They stood up. They were told that they would never marry because they spoke out, especially if they spoke in mixed company. They traveled the countryside, addressed political bodies, some of them for the first time, not the women's for the first time, the bodies for the first time, listening to a woman's voice. They were led, because they were doing this on the behalf of slaves at first, they were led to say, don't we have the same rights too? Why are we fighting for these rights for other people when, in fact, you look at the Louisiana State Codes at that point, the very famous essay by Angelina Grimke, where she went through the legal code that basically described the obligations and duties that a slave had to his owner and compared them with the obligations and duties that a wife had to a husband, and the wording was uncanny. It was so similar. So the similarity was very closely noted by them. And they said, why are we fighting for men's rights when we don't have these rights? We don't want to take them away from them. We want to fight for black rights as well. But shouldn't we be fighting for a wider cause? Then a watershed event occurred, the 1840 World Anti-Slave Conference in London, England. The abolitionist feminist Elizabeth Cady Stanton attended the 1840s convention and was embittered, as were many women there, by the utter dismissal that they received. These women who were accepted in America got on ships, great expense to themselves, great expectation, went over to London. The London Society for Anti-Slavery was nowhere near as welcoming to women as the American one was. They were thrown out of basically any participation in the conference. They were put in a shielded area, and curtains were drawn, and they could look down onto the proceedings. Many of the American men actually went behind the curtains with the women. They were so outraged. And when Elizabeth Cady Stanton came back to America, she met with Lucretia Mott and various other women who had been so outraged by this behavior, and that was the genesis of the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention, from which feminism in America, North America, is often dated. Unfortunately for feminism and for the individualist tradition, the Civil War erupted. That was 1861. And if war is the health of the state, as Randolph Bourne once claimed, it is also the death of individualism. And there's many reasons for this, one of them being that individualism is at its root an anti-statist ideology that vests power in individual people, not in collectives. And war involves an increase in state power that never seems to roll back after peace has been declared. Now, I want to use the American Civil War as a dividing point, after which feminism in North America went in simplistically speaking, two divergent ways. Actually, there was a mainstream, but if you wanted to define it by the extremes, there were two extreme ways that it diverged. One faction looked to government, the state, either to reform or to replace, you know, another state with what existed. The other faction looked to empowering the individual, to working through grassroots organizations that wanted to change societal attitudes. And to the extent such groups focused on government, the grassroots ones, it was to protest laws and to call for repeal. Now, after the Civil War, the key issue for most of feminism became the Constitution. Women wished to be included in the wording of the 14th and 15th Amendments that aimed at securing freedom for blacks. The 14th Amendment introduced the word male into the United States Constitution. The 15th Amendment assured that the right to vote could not be abridged because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. It made no reference to sex. And again, the abolitionist women felt betrayed. Elizabeth Anthony wrote, "We repudiated man's counsels forever." And this became a pivotal point at which I believe mainstream feminism became alienated from men. There's a sense in which I don't think feminism has ever recovered from that moment. And the issue that came to dominate feminism was women's suffrage, just as the issue that came to dominate in the 19th century, 20th century, was the ERA. Now, that's one road. Individualist feminism tended to take a very different road. What it did was basically find expression within radical social movements, especially free love and free thought, where they functioned as a radical segment representing and pursuing the interests of women. The most important vehicle for individualist feminism was free love, a movement that sought to separate the state from sexual matters such as marriage, adultery, divorce, and birth control. Free love demanded that such matters be left to the conscience and contracts of those involved. And again, as with the theory, I can provide only a taste, really just a sip, of the richness and the importance of this contribution to feminism and free love. I'm going to give you just basically one story that could be multiplied hundreds of times. In 1889, a woman who had risked her life in a self-induced abortion wrote to the libertarian periodical, Lucifer the Lightbearer, pleading, quote, "I know I am dreadful wicked, but I am sure to be in the condition from which I risked my life to be free, and I cannot stand it. Would you know of any appliance that could prevent conception? If there is anything reliable, you will save my life by telling me of it," end quote. The woman wrote to Lucifer, which was published and edited by a fellow named Moses Harman, because in the late 1800s, it was one of the few forms openly promoting birth control. Moses Harman insisted that women's self-ownership, again, a word that comes up, a term that comes up over and over again, must be fully acknowledged in all sexual arrangements. Unfortunately, he also ran afoul of the Comstock Act, which prohibited the mailing of obscene matter, but did not define what obscenity was constituted by. Whatever it was, it included birth control, however. A witch hunt ensued. In 1887, the staff of Lucifer was arrested for the publication, this is earlier, but had been arrested for the publication of three letters and indicted on 270 counts of obscenity. One letter had described the plight of a woman whose husband forced sex upon her, even though it tore the stitches from a recent operation, and it is, as far as I can find, and my speciality is going through periodicals on microfilm, one of the reasons I wear glasses now, from the basically 1840s through to about 1890s is the area I go through. It's the first letter I've ever seen of sex within marriage being called rape. Also the first time I've seen abortion being justified as a woman's body, a woman's choice, was in the 1870s in another individualist feminist periodical. But getting back to Harman, his legal battles against the Comstock laws continued from 1887 through to 1906. His last imprisonment, during which he spent a year at hard labor, often breaking rocks in the Illinois snow, occurred when he was 75 years old. At his own time, he was an internationally known figure. George Bernard Shaw once refused to come to America to tour, saying, if the brigands that are the United States government would do this to a man like Moses Harman, what chance do I have? To continue this story, just briefly, when the authorities came to arrest Harman in 1887, his 16-year-old daughter, Lillian Harman, was not present, even though she was on the arrest warrant. The reason she was not present is that she was already in jail. She was in jail because she had one of the first and earliest marriages that was conducted openly and flagrantly without church approval, without state sanction. Both she and the fellow she married in this untraditional way were thrown in jail. So I hope that gives you just a sense, just a flavor of the richness of the history that is unplumbed and is really just lying out there. If, in fact, any of you are in women's studies classes, I would encourage you to follow up on this because it would be an original essay. Many of the stories, I'd be happy to give you names afterwards of people. The Harmons are somewhat known. Many other people are not. Now, with a small taste of theory and a smattering of history, I want to move on to two thoughts that I hope my speech imparts to you and that I leave you with. First of all, the difference between radical and individualist feminism constitute the two extremes of the feminist movement. They are ideological opposites, and they define the two extreme boundaries. One advocates state control, the other self-control. One considers men to be the enemy. The other embraces men as valued partners, or at least doesn't see them as anything inherently antagonistic. Depends on the individual. Some individual men, I would never embrace as a valued partner. I say that of women as well, though. But the most important feature of the ideological divide is iFeminism's insistence on applying the profoundly personal, the profoundly individualistic principle, a woman's body, a woman's right, self-ownership, across the board to all issues. And the second thought I hope to take with you is that iFeminism is not merely a set of positions on issues, such as affirmative action. It's an entire vision with a complex network of theory underlying it, defining concepts such as class, justice, and equality, with a unique history and a unique interpretation of historical events such as the Industrial Revolution, with poets and martyrs. And for all of that, I want to return to how I began my talk and say that I hope very much that, as rich as this history is, that it's just a way station. Because the ideal is basically getting back to individuals being respected under law. And once their person and property are respected under the law, maybe we can get to the hard work of making sure that morally our culture also respects their dignity. Thank you.